And just to him, I'd like members to sign. And he's at the, for those who would like to perhaps pop in and see him, he's at the Life Rehabilitation Unit of Vincent Pilotti Hospital in Pinelands, in the Cape area here. So those of you who can afford that time, perhaps you can pop in and see him. So we will just pass the card around and members can sign off on it. Right. And we go then back to the program itself, and there's the briefing by DTI on the review of the bilateral investment treaties. Some of you will recall we have had some work done by the researchers, content specialists in this matter. I think content was it yourself, both of you were working jointly. So of course you've got that and you received that already. And now we hope that can assist in your engagement. So it'll be over to you. We welcome DDG Xavier Kirim, who joins us now, and over to the Minister again. Thank you.
Okay, well, as before, I'm just going to say a couple of opening remarks and then hand over the presentation to Xavier Kirim. I think that some of the discussion of this issue in the sort of South African media context has generated more heat than light. So I think it's important that we actually do try to show where we're coming from. What we are about in this whole exercise is we're about modernizing and making sure that we have an appropriate investment protection regime in South Africa. What we had previously was an investment protection regime in which there is in fact comprehensive and very substantial protection of property in the Constitution, which is of generic application to anybody who is involved in the South African economy, and is much more substantial than exists in many other jurisdictions. And then we had, on top of that, we had negotiated, I think more or less as a diplomatic exercise rather than anything else, a series of bilateral investment treaties in which we were extending investment protection bit by bit, if I can coin a phrase. And so we have these negotiated with a number of countries. I think you'll see from the presentation some of those that were signed, quite a lot of those that were signed were never ratified, never came into force. And then, like many other jurisdictions around the world, we've come to start to take stock of the investment protection regime we have in South Africa. Where do we need to position ourselves? There is a debate and a discussion going on in the United Nations Conference on Trade and Development. We've been participating in that, which is about what is the desirable norm for our investment protection. We are not alone in our peer countries in going through review exercise. A number of them are, some of them are starting later than us. Others of them have already arrived at a destination which I think is very similar to the one that that we are in. And all of them, I think, are recognized universally as providing very significant protection to private investors in their economy. So we are not involved in an exercise where we want to withdraw protection. We want to provide protection. We want to provide protection for investors not only against expropriation, but to give them national treatment. But we also want to avoid some of the pitfalls that we've identified. And also the fact of the matter is that we've got this piecemeal, as I said, bit-by-bit investment protection, which covers only some players and doesn't cover others. So our review exercise, I think Xavier will show, no correlation between foreign investment and the existence or non-existence of a bit. One key player already mentioned, no bit, sizable and growing foreign investment. There's the story. Other countries we've negotiated bits, no increase in foreign investment. So there's that. Then some of the issues that we've decided is that we went around and we thought that we would sign a model, which is now under review, in which all sorts of, it's a bit like bidding for the World Cup. You offer the earth, and then later on you see that there are a few issues. the issues that we've confronted have got nothing, they have nothing to do with any substantial investor with any substantial right. They're chances and speculators who've been taking advantage of some of the loopholes to try to get rulings in international agreements which are really not fundamental. And I give one which I think is actually an example which I think just stares us in the face, not even about South Africa. Uruguay wants to introduce tobacco product legislation like you have in Australia and other places, which is also now the subject of contestation, to make it compulsory to stick pictures of diseased lungs on the labels of the cigarettes and not have a brand displayed in any. They want to do that. Now that is, I think most of us would agree, is a sovereign decision that the country of Uruguay ought to be able to take on health grounds. It is being challenged in terms of these bits as amounting to expropriation, and the decision may be taken by, not by the decision will be taken by some tribunal sitting in Europe. And members of those tribunals, I've heard, say the problem is not with us as the tribunal, the problem is what you've written in your bits. So those are the exercises that we, along with other countries, are starting to talk about. So I just want to underscore the point, we are not about trying to remove protection from investors. We are about modernizing and improving the protection for investors, but we're trying to do it in a more comprehensive way with the development of an investment act, which will be generic, and then when the question of these investment treaties comes up, we will be in a position to, if there is a compelling economic or political case for negotiating or renegotiating treaties, we will propose a different model. And by the way, some of the heat has come up in the context of the European Union. The European Union is making a change. It is deciding. I don't think they've come up with exactly what the model is, but that investment agreements should no longer be at the level of individual members of the EU, but as a union competence. I think they're now talking about whether they should delegate that back down again, but they haven't. They are changing their model. So I think that really that's what we want to do. It's not withdraw protection, but to change and improve the regime. That's basically what it's about. So I think with that opening remark, let's hand over to Xavier. I should just say, Chair, I have to leave at 12 o'clock sharp. I have another meeting. It's not the meeting of opposition parties. I just want to underscore that. But I have something else that I can't avoid. So you'll have to excuse me at that point. Thanks.
Gidi G. Karim.
Thanks very much, Chair. And honourable members, good morning. We're very pleased that we have this opportunity to give an update on the work that we've been doing on the review of bilateral investment treaties in South Africa. I believe we have had a presentation previously, but it's probably more around 2 years ago, so we're pleased to have this opportunity to provide an update. I'd also like to just introduce two of my colleagues that work very closely with me and we helped to lead a team on this work. We have Keke Letso Mashigo sitting just behind me and Mustakim Degama. Keke deals with our preparations for engagement at the multilateral level, so with UNCTAD and with the OECD we engage with. And Mustakim is leading our preparations in preparing the new act as well as drafting the model the model investment, model bilateral investment treaty that we're going to put before the Interministerial Committee. Perhaps just to recall, I know that the presentation has already been circulated, so I'll try to go through this quickly. But to remind us of the background, in the immediate post-apartheid era between 94 and 98, we signed and concluded about 15 bilateral investment treaties. And these are the ones that have essentially entered into force. Most of them were concluded with European countries. And you recall also that the Constitution was only came into force in 1996. So some of the agreements that we've signed predated the new constitution in South Africa. A number of other bilateral investment treaties have been negotiated subsequently, but because of a lack of clarity on the ratification process, Most of those have not been ratified. I think we now have something like about 19 agreements that are in fact in force. At the time, ministers made the reference to this. This was an attempt, I think part of the entering, signing of these bilateral investment treaties at that time was to ensure investors that their investments would be secure under the new democratic government. It was also seen as part of of South Africa's re-entry to the international community, where we've been isolated under apartheid, and signing these bilateral investment treaties was also seen as the diplomatic signal of our return to the international community. In the years following, we observed a number of developments that drew our attention to some of the problems that were occurring in respect of investment treaties, bilateral investment treaties, but also multilateral investment treaties. In the late 90s, we observed the negotiations amongst OECD countries, all highly developed economies, trying to negotiate a multilateral agreement on investment. That negotiation collapsed, I believe it was in 1999 or 1998, showing some of the serious problems that are embedded in these agreements. We also participated in the process that led up to the launch of the Doha Round, where one of the issues on the agenda was the trade and investment issue, where there was an attempt to introduce new rules in the WTO at the multilateral level on trade and investment, and that, in the end, was also struck off the agenda of the WTO, mainly because of very serious disagreements between, in the main, developed and developing countries of what rules should obtain at the multilateral level. In the period following, I think the next focus was in the period following the financial crisis in 2001. There was a spike in international arbitration on using bilateral investment treaties as the basis for challenging government measures over the following years. And that drew a lot more attention to the concerns and the issues that are embedded in the bilateral investment treaties, and we were observing that. In South Africa, we've had two cases. We've had a Swiss challenge against South Africa a challenge on the basis of the Swiss bilateral investment treaty in 2004, and then a challenge on the basis of the Italian bilateral investment treaty and it should actually be stroke Italian and Belgian Luxembourg bilateral investment treaties in 2006, and that was against the Minerals Development Resource Act, the MPRDA, that was challenged in 2006. I think all of those factors combined to prompt us to look much more closely at the bilateral investment treaties that we had signed in the mid-90s. And we undertook an extensive review, extensive consultations at the national level. We also brought in international experts in the area, but more than a three-year review, which led to certain recommendations that were submitted to Cabinet in 2010. I must say the review is continuing. I mean, we're continuing to learn through the engagements, and we're continuing to improve our understanding of the effects of bilateral investment treaties. And what I've done in this, I think what we've done in this presentation is to actually include some issues that have emerged subsequent to the formal review between 2007 and 2010. I think one of the points of the review essentially was that there is a recognition that foreign direct investment can make a positive contribution to development. We were looking at the figures in preparation for this meeting, and according to the Reserve Bank figures for last year, FDI amounts to around 38% of the South African economy. So foreign direct investment is a significant contributor to South Africa's economic, to the economy and to our development. There's obviously a difference between FDI and portfolio investment and other financial flows in the sense that FDI implies long-term investment in productive activities. It brings along with it a range of other advantages, including improved access to the latest technology, to managerial skills, organizational and business practices, skills, and international markets, because most of the investment takes place through transnational corporations that are that have a global presence. What the review also indicated is that whether or not a country benefits from FDI is not cannot be assumed. It's not automatic. In order to ensure that you get the full range of benefits which are listed above, you need a set of regulations that balance both, on the one hand, effective protection of investment, but you also need measures that ensure that the FDI supports the national development objectives, establishes linkages to the national economy, augments and doesn't crowd out domestic financial resources, fosters enterprise development, and enhances the technology, skill, and knowledge base of the economy. So you need a range of measures in place in order to access the benefits of the economy. I think all of this is well known, but probably worth repeating. The ministers indicated also that there have been a number of other reviews around the world of investment treaties, and these are the ones that have been the most prominent, and these are all major players in international investment debates: Australia, Brazil, Canada, Norway, the US, and Sweden. And these reviews have been going over in the various countries over the last decade or so. There are obviously differences in what each of these reviews were focused on, how they developed, and the outcomes of the reviews. But there's generally a sense that the first generation bits, the bits negotiated in the 90s, were drafted in very broad terms, and they leave open, in terms of interpreting the provisions of the bits, a great deal of ambiguity, which gives arbitration panels that have to look at disputes that arise a great deal of scope to interpret in different ways. And that leads to a very unpredictable and inconsistent set of outcomes of arbitrational panels. Even on issues that you have the same, a similar matter is being looked at in different in different cases, you could have very different outcomes. The standard definitions that comprise the first generation bilateral investment treaties are: you would have provisions that would define what is an investor, what is an investment. You define national treatment, most favored nation, expropriation, and there we put in direct and indirect. There could be direct expropriation, but there could be measures that are seen as tantamount to expropriation that could also be included in this. There is a provision that investors need to have be treated fair and equitable, which sounds reasonable at one level, but in understanding it, what it could mean is that any change in the investment environment that affects the expectations of investors. Do I just keep?
Something we can work with.
I can work off the presentation, the paper. So a range of these provisions that I was talking about, the fair and equitable treatment provision, which essentially has been used. This has been the one provision that most arbitration cases have been lodged and won on, and essentially the interpretation of this is that any expectation that the investor may have about profits, if that's negatively affected, could use this provision to challenge the measure. And this has been the experience in a range of international arbitration cases over the last couple of decades. Probably what is underpinning this and what is most contentious, again, the Minister has made reference to it, is the investor state dispute settlement procedure, where you could get any investor from one of the countries that you've signed the bilateral investment treaty with, challenging a government measure. A range of problems with it, I've made reference that there are no common standards. There are a number of different arbitration systems. There's a UN system. There's the World Bank system. There are other international arbitration fora. Then there's no consistency between the fora in terms of their rules of procedure, in terms of how the cases are conducted. Even in some of the arbitration panels, there are inconsistent outcomes, as I'd indicated. So essentially creating a lot of unpredictability and uncertainty with respect to the international arbitration system. A very important concern, and this has been raised and could possibly even be seen to be unconstitutional in South Africa in some respects, is that by having a bilateral investment treaty and moving towards international arbitration, effectively you bypass the domestic court system. And it's just allowed for foreign investors, not for domestic investors. So over the same period, there's been a considerable rewriting of the bilateral investment treaties. We see the U.S., both the U.S. and Canada, which were the furthest advanced in terms of establishing international rules on investment, undertaking a serious rewrite of the model bid that they negotiate. So a lot of the problems that they identified in the bids that they signed in the 1990s, they've tried to correct these in the latest model, which I believe came out just last year, 2 years for the U.S., similarly for Canada. The Australians just last year announced that in any future bilateral investment treaty that it enters into, it's going to exclude investor state dispute provisions. They argue that the system, the legal system in Australia is sufficiently strong. They meet international standards for investor protection. And so investors who have any problems should use the national courts and not to resort to these types of provisions. And the Minister made reference also to the Australians are also, what has underpinned this also and strengthened this argument has been the challenge to their legislation on public health with respect to smoking. And that has been challenged under bilateral investment treaties. So the Australians have realized this and have made this new move. Brazil is in quite a lucky place. Brazil refused many. They negotiated about 15 bilateral investment treaties in the 90s and but when they submitted it to their Congress blocked it. So they have 15 that they've negotiated, and the Brazilian parliament blocked it, refused to accept passing any of these because they were considered to be unconstitutional, and particularly around the question of the investor state dispute settlement procedure, that this would bypass Brazilian courts. And so they're in that position. Both India and the EU are currently rethinking their approach to investment protection treaties. With the EU, it's been prompted by the coming into force in 2010 of the Lisbon Treaty, which passes the competence of negotiating investment treaties to the EU level. So there is a discussion underway on how you relate the EU level type protection with the existing bilateral investment treaties, and Europe has been the most prolific in terms of signing bilateral investment treaties, and there are a lot of inconsistencies in the different investment treaties that different European countries have signed with different countries. So there is a question of how you locate how you create some kind of alignment in that, and also make sure that the investment treaties is consistent. The investment treaties are consistent with other European laws and policies. So there's a very serious rethink on this underway in the EU. Similarly with India, just last year there were a few serious challenges that the Indian government had to deal with, and this has prompted them to review their approach to bilateral investment treaties. So the new generation of BITs, again, at a general level, are essentially aimed at reducing the risks inherent in the earlier agreements, and it's really around ensuring that the drafting of the provisions is much more clear and much more precise of what it includes, what it excludes, defining investor and investment more precisely, defining what you mean by expropriation, defining what you mean by compensation, etc., etc. Minister made reference to the work that is being done at the United Nations Conference on Trade and Development. And essentially, I think one of the key points in that process is how you develop an approach to investment treaties that puts inclusive growth and sustainable development at the center of your framework. And that's sort of the point that the debate in UNCTAD has hinged on and has been built around that. The new approach also attempts to secure the rights of government to regulate in the public interest in issues on environment protection, on questions of public health or tobacco legislation, etc. A new approach to investment treaties would not take away the right of government to regulate in that perspective. And more generally, there's a sense that investment protection needs to be located in a range of other laws at an international level and at a national level within the broader context of a human rights framework. Other aspects of the review showed that there was no clear relationship between bilateral investment treaties and increased FDI inflows. This is confirmed in numerous studies by the World Bank and by UNCTAD, and it's confirmed in South Africa's experience. As the Minister indicated, we get investment from the US and India, and both continuing to grow. We don't have any bilateral investment treaties with them. We don't get investment treaties with a number of countries that we have bilateral investment treaties with. So there's obviously it's not decisive in attracting investment. It's not an explanation as to why one would get or not get investment, whether or not you have a bilateral investment treaty in place or not. We also went and did quite a lot of work to try to compare South Africa's investment regime vis-a-vis other countries, and particularly OECD countries from whom we get traditionally got most of our investment from. Our assessment, and we did this over an extended period in close collaboration with the OECD, is South Africa is open to foreign direct investment. I've just given an indication, something like 38% of our economy is owned by foreigners. We continue to receive new investment flows. So despite what we hear in the press about declines in South Africa not faring very well, the fact of the matter is, except for this 2008 period, every year over the last decade, FDI flows to South Africa have increased. It's on a steady upward swing, except for 2008, where, like the global trend, we took a decline. We've also tried to compare the levels of protection compared to international best practice or international standards. OECD provides one standard, UNCTAD provides another standard, there are obligations in the WTO, and by all of that assessment, South Africa is comparable on all dimensions of the types of protection we provide to foreign investment. The essential outcome of the review was that, and this is the recommendation that the review made, was submitted to Cabinet, is that we need to look at how we could strengthen domestic investor protection, particularly with respect to the provisions that are contained in bilateral investment treaties, if we clarify that, and that we also ensure that in doing so that we bring our bids in line with international developments in terms of what we are seeing in the international debate. Cabinet met in July 2010, and there are a couple of points to make on the decision. Cabinet decided that we needed to work to modernize, update, and strengthen South Africa's investment protection regime, and that work be initiated in this respect. Cabinet recognized clearly that there was no direct relationship between BITS and FDI, that the relationship is at best ambiguous. But it also recognized that the bilateral investment treaties that we have signed pose risks and constrains a government's ability to regulate in the public interest in light of some of the earlier points that we've made about public health or environment, etc. And that we needed to update our bilateral investment treaty and ensure that it's aligned with national legislation, the constitution, and developments in international investment treaty making. There were five core decisions that came out of the cabinet meeting in July 2010. First, develop a new investment act to codify and clarify typical BIT-like provisions into domestic law and strengthen domestic protection in that respect. Cabinet also instructed that we terminate first generation BITs, those BITs that are in force, that came into force in the immediate post-94 period, and at the same time offer partners the possibility to renegotiate the terms of those bilateral investment treaties. Third, to refrain from entering into bilateral investment treaties in future unless there are compelling economic and political reasons to do so. Fourth, to develop a new model BIT as a basis for any new negotiations or as a basis for renegotiations of old bilateral investment treaties. And very importantly, rather than leaving it at the level of bureaucrats, the decision to enter into bilateral investment treaties was given to, was set out to for the Interministerial Committee to oversee the process. So the DTI Minister of Trade and Industry convenes the meeting. It brings together National Treasury, Foreign Affairs, DERCO, EDD, Economic Development, and Agriculture as the oversee to oversee the process of this work. We've made reference to the fact that we've been actively participating in the international dialogue on investment treaty making, both at UNCTAD and in the OECD. We've also introduced the issue onto the agenda of the BRICS meeting, and we'll have an ongoing discussion with in that context about developing a similar approach or a coordinated approach to this issue. The other area of work that is currently going on is that the termination process following the cabinet decision is underway. Some of it is being driven by the specific provisions in each of the agreements where they have specific dates within which you have to terminate. Otherwise, the agreements are automatically extended for another 10, 15 years. So and they're not all the same, but the Belgian-Luxembourg agreement, we had until September last year to notify intention to exit from it, or it would have been extended for another 10, 15 years. So there was no sort of targeting Belgium or Luxembourg per se. It was simply to follow the terms of the agreements. It's important to note that even where an agreement is terminated, the protection that is provided by that agreement for the investors of the partner countries continue for an additional 10 to 15 years. So the effective protection under that investment is extended for another 10 to 15 years. It's very important because it's not as if by terminating all of a sudden that protection disappears. I mean, it's still in place, and obviously it's in addition to the national legislation protecting an investment as well. We have had, last year we had a number of engagements with the EU and the member states, mainly because most of the agreements that are going to be terminated are of European Union members. And so the EU in particular is interested in what is happening on this, and we've had fairly long, extensive engagements with them at ambassadors' level, at the more technical level, to clarify our thinking and our approach on this. The other area of work that we're doing is to develop a new model bilateral investment treaty. I think our work is largely done at the technical level, at the legal level. We have to take it through the IMC, the investment IMC, and hopefully that would be it would then be cleared to be submitted to cabinet, and then perhaps ratified or brought to parliament at the appropriate time. We're also doing extensive work on drafting this new Foreign Investment Act, and it's not going to cover every aspect of investment in South Africa. I mean, I was saying there's extensive legislation covering different aspects of investment in South Africa, but it's really focused around clarifying the types of provisions that you find in bilateral investment treaties and clarifying it, locating it in national law, and ensuring that it's consistent with our constitution and existing legislation. Sort of some of the principles are to update and modernize, strengthen investor protection, incorporate BITS-type provisions into national legislation, ensure that we remain open to foreign direct investment, provide adequate security and protection to all investors, and ensure appropriate balance between the rights of investors, the rights and obligations of investors on the one hand, and also on government on the other, and preserve the right to regulate in the public interest. We expect that we'll be ready to submit the first draft to the IMC at its next meeting, and we would take further work may be required on that.
Please, DDG, Minister.
I just wanted to add something that Xavier said. He talked about the figure of the percentage of FDI. I think what was important is that figure has been growing as a percentage of the GDP over recent years. And that the point he's been making about financial flows, portfolio investments, and the distinction with FDI, I think is very important. I just wanted to just read out with your permission a paragraph or two from Ernst & Young's 2012 Africa Attractiveness Survey, which came out yesterday. And it actually points out that South Africa has been a popular destination for FDI for a number of decades. And it says, this trend has continued over the period 2003 to 11. Although FDI capital inflows have been lower than those going to oil-rich countries like Nigeria and Angola, this trend, it says, partly reflects South Africa's own wealth and capital investing capacity, but also the changing and increasing diversified nature of the South African economy, with service sectors now contributing more than 65% to GDP. This diversification is reflected in the makeup of FDI flows, much of which is now directed towards generally less capital-intensive manufacturing and services. As a result, South Africa is the leading FDI destination in Africa in terms of project numbers. FDI inflows into South Africa are forecast to average about $10 billion per year over the next 5 years, with approximately 125,000 new jobs created as a result. That's the investment pipeline we talk about, the FDI pipeline. It is continuing to grow. And I think that just to contextualize a point that was made by Xavier. That came from, not from us, that came from Ernst & Young report released yesterday. Thank you very much.
Chair?
Yes. Sorry. Could we've only got a page or two to complete. Unless this is with the Minister who will be going shortly.
Was that $10,125,000 for Africa or South Africa? South Africa.
Thank you. DDG, just a minute. DDG, I think you were just finishing off then. Was that correct? Yeah.
I can't say thank you and I can't say questions.
Thank you very much, DDG. Thank you, Minister. I think I'm glad that we're unpacking this again now. Honourable van der Merwe, Honourable McIntosh.
Thank you very much, Chair. This is a very interesting development. I would like to ask First of all, on your slide 8 about the cabinet decisions, that seems to me to summarize a lot of the current work that you're doing, the core elements of the decision. And the one about terminating the first generation BITs, now you've discussed that a little bit in terms of the Benelux one and the notification. But can you give us an idea of whether we are going to receive some resistance, or what kind of reaction will there be when we start to terminate the existing BITs? The other thing, question I want to ask is, what about, you haven't talked about protection of South African investment elsewhere. Now, that is particularly relevant, I think we can all be quite honest and say, in the Zimbabwean case. What about South African companies who are investing in other countries? How do we view that process going forward? Is it still under the same cabinet imperative to get rid of them, basically, and change the model? Thank you.
Honourable McIntosh.
Madam Chair, I'm partly covered by those questions. Just to add to that very last one, we've got quite a lot of South African farmers moving into Africa, and they have done that by negotiations with African governments and through AgriSA in a very responsible way. And I gather they are very alarmed, partly because maybe they haven't heard this presentation, which is quite calming down, about unilateral ending of BIT. So that links on to your point. And, of course, Zimbabwe has been our African or Southern African nightmare for the last few years. The other question, I do want to say, Madam Chair, I think we're very reassured that the Minister's made it quite clear there's no way there's not going to be an investor protection regime. I think that's important. I think it's also because the public and certainly investors, although I think investors perhaps do their homework, are not always well informed. I don't know how many people know that in the beginning of the 1950s, the National Party, as policy when they came to power in 1948, was to nationalize the mines. And it had a very bad effect on investments. Now, the Italians, I think, I know just from reports, I think have regarded our Mineral Resources Act as a de facto nationalization. And, of course, that's a debate I don't want to get into. But it exactly. But the point is, no, but that's my concern. You know, some of you who've gone to get money from banks and things, they say, look, we don't mind giving you the money, but just get your old man to sign a guarantee, and then you can have the money. So they want that undergirding support from a sovereign source. And in a sense, I think these agreements are partly to give that security. And I know it hasn't apparently stopped our FDIs, but that's in a sense an argument from silence. If Julius Malema had not been making all these statements and so on, I think we might have had more investment. So, and look, for those of us who are close to the scene, we know it's a lot of noise, and we don't take Malema seriously, certainly not now anymore. But the point is, Madam Chair, I think that the encouraging thing is that the investment protection regime is about people knowing that investments are secure in a country. And I think the Minister's reassurance that will remain in some form, and I think the presentation by Mr. Karim has made cogent arguments, which is all around the world, why one needs to modernize it and look at a new model for investments. But I'm quite encouraged, but my question links on to Honourable Van der Merwe. What about South Africans investing in other countries?
Honourable Hill-Lewis.
Chair, I was going to ask about timing, but Mr. Karim partly answered that by saying they had to do this before September. Of course, the timing couldn't possibly have been worse for us, coming just a month after Marikana and the global kind of skepticism towards South Africa that followed that tragedy. You know, I agree that this presentation is very calming and reassuring, but the fact is, you know, with respect, the department didn't do a great job of doing of calming and reassuring investors in September when this news broke. And, you know, I would just suggest that you have a look at the way that you communicate these things in future, because not enough of this information, just ordinary common sense stuff and process stuff, got out there in September when the world really did take a bit of had a bit of a double take when this was announced. And I think it did hurt us, you know, whether it was entirely innocent and just stock standard process or not, it did hurt us on the international scene.
Thank you very much.
Minister, just if you could share with us a little bit more on the interministerial committee there, but also the development of a new investment act. I think you have gone into details about, although the BITS first generation, you are adopting the approach or policy to terminate them, nevertheless there are renegotiation possibilities. I take it that applies to all BITS that we have entered into so far.
Let me start off. I think exactly what I said at the moment, at the beginning, the very first thing I said on this subject was the debate has generated more heat than light. And I think that we've had to deal with a lot of misperceptions, and I'm glad that members have commented that this has been a reassuring and a calming exercise, because it's never been what it was presented as. And I will take the point that maybe, you know, we should have improved our communication, although I think our message to the key stakeholders, for example, in the European Union and so on, was exactly what we were saying. We're modernizing, we're updating, and here we have an old agreement, and we were faced with, I mean, maybe the circumstances, if we had other circumstances, we could have held it back for 6 months or something like that, but it wasn't open to us. We either took a decision to terminate at that point, or it was automatically rolled over for a decade. That was the choice we had. So we took the decision that let's modernize, let's go consistently with what we did. The other one, we have engaged with organized agriculture, who came to us on exactly the same perception. We're now pulling all the bits with Africa, we're undermining the situation. We said to them, well, look, the same story. They continue to enter into force, and I think that we would want to be consistent. We were not going to sign something with another African country that we're not prepared to sign ourselves. So if it comes to it, we will negotiate. If there's a compelling economic and political reason, we will be prepared to negotiate with another country, another African country. By the way, the agreement we have with Zimbabwe a few years ago, which was precisely for that, does not cover retrospective land claims. That was the terms of the agreement with them. So just to make that very, very clear. That agreement, I think, was seen to be politically and economically necessary because it did create the kind of confidence that was necessary at that point in time. But as I said, we would negotiate. If we felt it was necessary, there were compelling reasons, we would negotiate a new generation model. But I think that I'm not quite sure how many of those countries where the South African farmers have been, where there is a bidding force, because the picture we were told is many of them were not actually ratified. So I think those are, you know, they probably are operating without a bid at this moment in time. The approach of the IMC is that it's not only with the existing bits, it's with any potential new bits. And I think the phrase, to just repeat it, compelling economic or political reason, we would consider whether we would have a negotiated bit with somebody. And I think basically what you would say is there some high level of investment that's potentially going to flow, and they told us if we don't sign a bit, we can't have it. If it's something like that, of course we'll consider it. But then we'll put forward a new generation bit as a proposal. That's the approach we would take. The Investment Act, the work is pretty far advanced, actually. We're looking to another date for the IMC again. I think we're pretty far advanced with the Investment Act. I don't know in terms of the parliamentary program and so on and so forth. I can't tell you when it might appear before you. But we do have quite a lot of work that's done on that. Mm-hmm. Um, and uh, I think that this is an opportunity among others to deliver the message. South Africa is a country that is open to foreign direct investment. South Africa is a country, as I read out from Ernst & Young, is a country where foreign investors know they can come and that they have rights and conditions and a business environment that they are familiar with. There are many, many companies, I keep saying this, we have Marikana, we've had a situation in the mining industry also to do with the fact that, as I said earlier, mineral prices are falling, and we've had a situation caused by the instability of the world economy and some perceptions or whatever, which has affected a portfolio investment. But the foreign investment, foreign direct investment pipeline continues to be in place. We had a 1 billion rand investment the other day announced by Unilever. I meet with Paul Polman. I got a thing from him. I see him regularly. He's the CEO of Unilever Worldwide. He knows he's got to grow his business in Africa. He's European-based. He's a Dutch citizen. He can't crack it there any longer. He's got to come here. He's looking to South Africa and Africa as a major headquarters for their African business. They know they're going to do it. They don't say there are no challenges in the South African market. They're challenges we work with them on. And that is a message across a number of FDI people. There are actually not too many FDI people that just walk in and set up their plant. We don't get to hear about it. They always want to know what are the incentives in place, what are the support mechanisms in place, and so on. So TISA works on these things. All that stuff that happens in the motor industry when we announce these things, it doesn't happen by chance. It happens because people come and engage with us. We know we have a pipeline of FDI. And by the way, if I could just blow our trumpet a little bit, the chief director in charge of investment promotion, Yunus Hussein, I'm sure some of you know, has just been elected the vice president of the Association of International Investment Promotion Agencies. So I think that's it tells you the quality of the cadres that we have in place doing this kind of work. That is the picture. And we are telling people, yes, he's a cadre. He's a cadre. A cadre is someone who has got particular skills and capabilities and capacities and is at the service of the country in promoting FDI. That's the sense of the term. I don't know how he votes when the election comes. The point I want to make is that the investment protection regime we develop in South Africa with the Investment Act and with the approach to investment treaties is clearly intended to push that forward in ways that are going to develop or enable us to promote inclusive growth and employment in this country. Thank you.
I know that we are coming just to a close at this point, but in the beginning of February, a working group in the United Nations agreed to new transparency rules for international arbitration. And I know you've given a broad response with our respect to international arbitration, but particularly with this one in the first week of February, on the 8th. Where are we on that particular one? Is there any other information you can give the committee in this regard? Look, if it's not forthcoming as we sit here, if it's not forthcoming, we can, of course, request that you come back to us with one or two other questions which we would like to see responded to, because the issues such as, we haven't got the Development Act yet, the investment one, but in principle we have taken a decision to terminate the bits without that. What would be the implications? Although you did say, Minister, that the protection continues for 10 years or whatever. But it's just one or two clarifications in that regard as we go forward. Because in the past, it would appear as if there was a template for bits. I say appear, I don't really know. And then that had to sort of just, everything had a bit almost fit into that without being sufficiently strategic. That was the impression one got about this. having said that, Minister, and DDG and DG, I would like to thank the department, yourself, Minister, for coming here. This particular engagement is long overdue, as you know. And it's interesting to know that the Brazilian Parliament just threw out this whole issue. And it is at the time we began to exercise the authority and powers of Parliament with respect to this kind of thing. So, but of course, they're working together in this regard. But thank you very much, Minister, and the Department.